Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is humanity outgrowing the planet? Then, what few people understand about Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and philosophy. We are joined by Paul Ehrlich, president of the Center for Conservation Biology and the Bing Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University. He is the author of Population Bomb, Human Nature's Genes, Culture, and the Human Prospect, and A World of Wounds, Ecologists and the Human Dilemma. Welcome, Paul Ehrlich. It's great to have you on the Scholar Circle. I wanted to start with your work on human natures, which you use the plural term, natures, instead of the singular nature. You argue against the idea that we have a singular fixed nature. What do you say is happening?
Well, first of all, what we've learned over the last 20 years is that we don't have anywhere near enough genes to dictate the kind of things most people think of as human nature. Almost all of it is cultural, and everybody's got a different cultural background, and so basically people individually are all different, and there are none of the putative genetic controls on our behavior and so on that most people seem to think of as being genetic. The differences between people of different skin colors, for example, we understand fully as being related to the amount of solar radiation they get and have nothing whatever to do with intelligence, personality, so on and so forth. So the reason for calling the book Human Natures was to put to death the idea that we are naturally aggressive or that men are naturally more reproductively prolific than women and so on. So that's the basic reason for calling it Human Natures. We've just learned an awful lot more about genetics and natural selection in the last 25 or so years than we knew when I first became a geneticist back in the 1950s. We've been learning more and more about this, and it turns out work done by a guy named Alan Wilson, who was a New Zealander who worked at Berkeley for many years, and with his student about 1975 or so, Mary Claire King, who showed that it isn't mostly what differences we have in genes between us and the chimpanzees, but in how those genes are regulated. And this has produced a whole new area in biology, an area now often called genomics, in which we're trying to understand how natural selection can operate on so very few genes tied together in networks to regulate them to make differences big enough to, produce a real human being or a chimpanzee or a George W. Bush, you know.
How does that tie in with the epigenetic work that is now arising, where people are seeing behavioral patterns or emotional patterns that are passed on from offspring to offspring despite not having these same experiences?
Right, right. There is a sort of hangover that you can get. Basically, for instance, babies that were born during the famous cases, babies that were born during the terrible Dutch famine in the winter of 1944-45, when the Germans were still occupying Holland, that it turned out that those kids, when they grew up, tended to be more obese when they had decent diets, and in fact, their children tended to be more obese. That is, there was a carryover that was in the way genes were regulated that was passed on from generation to generation for a while. So in some ways, Lamarck, who was one of the original evolutionists but had, in the view of almost all of us, the wrong approach to it, namely the idea that the reason giraffes had long necks is they spent a lot of time stretching their necks trying to feed on leaves high on trees, that actually there was a little more to Lamarckism than we had thought, although the main mechanism of evolution still remains natural selection. That is one kind of organism outbreeding the others, but it's much more complex than we once thought.
You said that you are convinced that culture is the major driver. How are these things intertwined?
Well, they're intertwined in the sense that some things, again, it's to talk about genes doing something and environment doing something is like talking about the area of a rectangle being caused by the length or by the width. There's no way you can separate them. That is, you can't have genes without an environment. And for organisms, you can't have an environment without genes, and they're absolutely tied together. If you want to think about the things that are constrained seriously by your genes, it tends to be things like headedness. Almost everybody has only one head, and that's apparently programmed pretty well into our genes. The sorts of things that aren't is, say, a desire for women to be attracted to men who drive fast cars, or for people who have dark skins to be more intelligent than people who have sort of funny gray skins, so-called whites, and so on. Those are the things we now know are not heavily determined by which structural genes you happen to inherit. There's something that comes along from culture. And how do we know that? In other words, actually things, the importance of culture can be obvious to everybody from their everyday experience or from things they know about. For example, there were the famous identical twins, Chang and Ang. They had exactly the same genetics, were tied together in the chest by a bland band of flesh so that they couldn't be separated. And yet one of them became a drunk and the other was sober, and another became conservative and the other one was liberal. If you think about one of the main things that human beings do, certainly the most important thing that separates us from all other animals, that is the development of language with syntax. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of experiments in which very young children are taken from a parental couple and given to an adoptive couple. And what's the invariable result? You take German kids from German parents and have them raised by French parents, and guess what? They grow up speaking French. I knew a guy in the Arctic many years ago named Harry Gibbons, who was an Eskimo, and a very pompous wing commander from the Royal Canadian Air Force landed his Lancaster bomber on an ice strip at Southampton Island, where I was, jumped out of the airplane, saw Harry Gibbons standing there, pointed down and said, "How thicky icy." And Gibbons looked at him with a big smile and said, "In actual fact, it's about 6 feet 3 inches thick right here." He had been raised by Oxford-trained British parents in Fort Churchill. So that's another way we know that culture overrides. Maybe the most important way is we know if there's any message at all that's programmed into your genes, it's out-reproduce your buddies. That's how natural selection works. Now, I've done a big survey. I've probably asked in public lectures 20,000 audiences of mixed, both males and females, how many women in the audience either have had or plan to have more than 30 children. Actually, I haven't run into one yet. In fact, there's no human culture that we know of where reproduction is maximized. How do you avoid the maximization of reproduction? Well, as far as we know, historically, the first records we know are that Egyptians used crocodile dung suppositories, the women did, to avoid conceiving. I don't know whether they worked or not. It sounds to me like they probably were pretty effective. But all cultures limit the number of kids they have, even though their genetic commands are to maximize them. The whole contraceptive situation, the fact that no culture breeds to the level that they could, tells you that culture can override genetics. There are other ways we know also, but basically, it's crystal clear.
How do we factor in some of the brain research now that is coming out that shows, for example, brains of killers are different from brains of normal people, and different kinds of killers have different brains? I know this isn't necessarily genetics in your field, but it's also not culture.
No, in fact, it can easily be culture. The size of your brain and the characteristics of your brain are actually easily changed during your life depending on your environment. For example, people who are blinded find the visual areas of the brain being taken over by the hearing parts of the brain and improving the capacity to hear. So there's a very long and distinguished literature saying how the brain can adapt to various lesions, various problems. So quite easy to change the characteristics of the brain in terms of the environment which the brain matured. But of course, you also can have genetic differences in the brain. The issue is how it's wired up and what kind of mutations are involved and how many genes can be involved in doing that. And it's a very complex subject. A good summary of the current situation is that we know that natural selection can act effectively. I mean, for example, when I was a kid, I made strains of fruit flies resistant to DDT in 10 generations with no problem at all, just selecting. That is, breeding from the ones that didn't die as easily when I exposed them to DDT. We have no idea today how that actually worked. In other words, I thought then there were millions of genes, and that what we were doing was breeding from flies that happened to have two or three genes that produced the right enzyme that detoxified the DDT. Now we know the fruit flies only have a 10 or 20,000, I don't remember exactly, 10 or 20,000 genes, and we don't understand how we managed to evolve DDT resistance without changing other parts of the developmental path of the fly by changing those genes, because the genes are all tied together. So it's a very complicated issue, an exciting one now in evolution. Again, we understand how natural selection does work in practice. We don't understand how it works in theory, which is kind of a weird situation.
So we know that it's happening. We don't know if this is passed on genetically or if this is passed on epigenetically. We just know it's passed on.
Right. And we're learning more and more about some of these things.
You've been focusing more now on the population issues.
The most recent paper that has gotten attention, I think, is one that Ann and I published, asked for by the Royal Society a year ago, on what our chances are of avoiding a total collapse of civilization. And that's the area which I'm most involved in, but that involves not just genetics and about demographics, but also politics and all kinds of social science, and one thing after another, climate science, toxification of the planet, that is the way we're spreading toxic chemicals everywhere, which have influence on our development, can change the way our genes act, for instance. So it's a very complicated area, but it involves being willing to go almost anywhere to look at it. I've probably spent more time professionally working with economists in the last 20 years than I have, say, with geneticists.
Economists, why?
Because, believe it or not, there are some really smart economists. We're not talking about the people who write for the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. People like Ken Arrow, who's the smartest economist on the planet, and the first Nobel Prize in economics. Partha Dasgupta, who was head of the European Economic Association and the British Economic Association. Larry Goulder, who is chair of our economics department. All these people understand you can't have a system that grows forever and survive. That's impossible. And yet, virtually every Wall Street Journal type idiot economist thinks the cure to everything is more growth, when everybody who can take off their shoes to count up to 20 knows that that's not the cure, it's the disease. And so we're working very hard with the smart economists, trying to figure out ways to take advantage of what economists know to design a system that'll avoid a collapse. But it's a slow process, and it's certainly working against the standard view of society. You know, every president gets up there and says, we got to get back to economic growth. We got to have more people, and so on. For instance, when the United States passed 300 million people, that's about 180 million more people than there's ever been the slightest excuse for having alive at one time in the United States. All of the media celebrated it like it was an accomplishment of some kind. We're now almost up to 320. You know, we have close to 3 billion people not properly fed on the planet, and everybody's looking forward to going from today's 7 billion to over 9 billion, something like 9 billion in 2045.
Well, some people are quite concerned about that. Of course, you being one of them with your famous book, The Population Bomb. People started out projecting more than 9 billion, but it sounds like the demographics are starting to change, particularly in Europe and the U.S.
There's a lot of dispute about what's happening demographically. There are some signs that the worst thing is happening, namely that fertility rates are going up in the rich countries. And, of course, it's the rich countries that are basically, because of their overconsumption, that are basically destroying our life support systems. But the basic point is we should be shifting the entire human enterprise to a smaller scale. And that means, for example, I just saw today an article written by an idiot about Japan's population crisis. Japan is vastly overpopulated. It's not going to be able to feed itself as climate change comes along. It doesn't have most of the resources it needs. And fortunately, its population is moving towards shrinkage, which every population should be. But because of the idiocy of economics and politics, everybody thinks that shrinking a population is a very dangerous thing, when actually growing a population is as dangerous as you can get. If you know the situation with resources, if you know the situation with our natural capital and our life support systems, you know we're right on the edge now. I have only one big debate among my colleagues in ecology. Jim Brown, who's, I think by agreement, the member of the National Academy and the greatest biogeographer in the world, says I'm crazy when I say that there's a 10% chance of avoiding a total collapse of civilization. I often say that, and I say that I'm willing to work to make it an 11% chance because I have great-grandchildren and I care about the world they're going to live in. But Jim says I'm nuts. He says there's only a 1% chance, but he's willing to work to make it 1.1%. So that's the kind of debate that I'm in. There's a lot of disagreement in the scientific community about whether there's any chance at all of avoiding a collapse, particularly when we put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere last year than we had for I think it was 5 or 6 years. The world as a whole is still putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The whole planet is covered with toxic substances. We're losing the biodiversity that runs our life support systems. Agriculture is in desperate trouble. Paper after paper, I'm talking at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meetings this year on what are the chances of being able to feed 9 billion people. They're dim. So I think the sign of how bad our society is and our media are came when the Intergovernmental Program on Climate Change released its report about 2 months ago now, saying we're in deep, deep trouble. And it didn't get as much coverage on the evening news as the retirement of a Dodger baseball pitcher. As you know, one of my colleagues commenting on the broken educational system in Australia, which is probably as broken as ours, summed it up very nicely. He said that any society where the primary cultural things are sports and mall crawling will never have a decent educational system. And I think that's true.
Some people attribute that also to the addictive behaviors that we're assimilating. I wonder how much that's tied into culture.
I think it's very tied into culture because our culture, for instance, is tied into money and consumption. You know, there's very famous work in anthropology, a study many, many years ago, I would say in the 50s or 60s, by Marshall Salins, who pointed out that hunter-gatherers had a leisurely lifestyle, that the average hunter, they were never hungry, they always were very equitable, shared food, did not lord it over other people, and they worked about 2.5 days a week. In other words, that was 6 hours, it was something like 20 hours a week total to get everything they needed. In other words, they maximized luxury. When I first came to Stanford in 1959, both Ann, I had to work, even though the salary was terrible, but Ann was able to stay home with a kid. But nowadays, every young couple at Stanford, as far as I can tell, both people have to have a job and work like crazy, often more than 40 hours a week each. So the issue is, what are we maximizing in our society? Basically, it's being able to consume more and more junk. We're turning into a situation of, it's basically a corporate oligarchy. In other words, as Corton wrote in his book, corporations are beginning to rule the world. You see this all the time. For example, the major, I think it's one of the two most used herbicides called atrazine, has been shown by a scientist at Berkeley, Tyrone Hayes, very clearly with many colleagues and collaborators around the world to be extraordinarily dangerous to the development of virtually all animals, including human beings. And the response of the company that makes atrazine was to spend, I think it was several million dollars, just attacking Hayes and putting together strategies to try and discredit him. That's the situation we have in the world today. And these same kind of people, I hate to tell you, run the media too. That probably has never occurred to you. I was a correspondent for NBC News for about 5 years, and I could tell you stories that I won't.
You were talking about hunter-gatherers, and there was something else in your 2010 book that was about how they measured affluence in some of these chiefdoms. The standards were generosity rather than accumulation.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things is particularly was characteristic of some cultures in northwestern North America, the Kwakiutl in particular in British Columbia, where the way you gain prestige was by burning your goods. They had things called potlatches, and you showed that you were a really big man because you could burn more canoes and blankets than the next guy. And in some sense, we have a sort of potlatch society because we design everything to be thrown away rather than preserved forever. I mean, one of our big problems is, for instance, you could build a refrigerator that'll keep your beer cold for 300 years. But if you do that, the refrigerator business doesn't do so well, so they make refrigerators that break down and have all kinds of junk on them so that they maybe only last for 15 or 20 years or less. So the way one gets prestige in a society depends on what kind of society you have. In hunter-gatherer societies, for example, prestige and command comes according to the circumstances. You go out on a hunt, and the best hunter in the group leads the hunt. But when you get back to camp, it may be a very old woman who understands best how to arrange the next ceremony that there's going to be, so that leadership moves according to the situation. In band, what are called generally band-type societies, it moves to where you will have a leader, but the leader has to maintain his or her position all the time by leading by example, by doing the cleanup himself and saying to people, come on, help along with it, you know. And then you get to chieftainships where it's hereditary, and you get to our society where it's determined by money. And so leadership is a very different thing depending on the sort of organization you have.
The other aspect of this hunter-gatherers to today, in your 2010 book, Humanity on a Tightrope, you wrote about an element that you think is the big missing element, which is empathy. If you could tell us the science and history of empathy and how can it be developed if it is in fact one of the big missing pieces?
Well, the empathy, of course, is a little different from sympathy. You can be sympathetic with a person or an animal in trouble without really putting yourself into that animal or that person's shoes. And I think that we have this huge problem of having shifted from groups for, you know, for most of human history, for let's say 200,000 years at least, and probably a couple of million, we lived in groups of somewhere between 25 or 50 and 150 people. And this gave us a cultural background that's really interesting if you think about it. That is, you knew basically everybody you ran into. Not only that, they were like you. They spoke the same language you had, and languages, of course, change all the time. But we know, for instance, from New Guinea, where there are, I can't remember exactly, but hundreds and hundreds of languages on one island because their groups are isolated. So the odds were that the people you saw virtually every day looked like you, spoke your language, whereas any stranger coming along didn't look like you and didn't speak your language. Some interesting things that probably they tended to be much less concerned about sexual fidelity, because if somebody was, say, if your wife was cheating with somebody, it was probably very closely related to you or your brother, so that any kids that were produced had your genes. And the society was a very different place where people not only could put themselves in other people they knew's shoes, but in a sense they were very, very close to those people. In other words, there was no, you didn't have to imagine it. Now, when you think about a kid or a person in sub-Saharan Africa, where they're only getting 2,000 calories a day of food and they're malnourished and so on, that's something you're not familiar with at all. It makes you very difficult for you to put yourself in their shoes. But since we're all in the same boat, it's really important that we learn to put ourselves in the shoes of people either that are distant from us in space, like the sub-Saharan African person that you're trying to consider, or in time, your children and your great-grandchildren, and particularly your great-great-grandchildren. In other words, how do we learn to put ourselves in the position of people that we will never see and are never going to meet, that are, say, our great-great-grandchildren? And yet we are changing the world in ways that's going to have dramatic effects on our great-great-grandchildren. If we don't learn to put ourselves in their shoes, then they're going to be in really tough shape if they exist at all. So this is a major, major problem, is learning in society how to put yourself in other people's shoes. And while you might say, well, what the hell did posterity ever do for me? What do I care about my great-great-grandchildren? You should care about the people in Africa and Asia and so on who, A, will be more susceptible to diseases that could be transmitted to you, B, that when they're starving, they may have nuclear weapons, which would not be so great for you. And on a purely selfish basis, we should be caring a lot more about things like redistribution. In the U.S., we can't grow our way out of the current situation where 1% of the people control most of the money in the country. There's going to have to be redistribution. I remember dramatically the right wing accusing Obama of being a redistributionist, which was, they have a really good sense of humor because, of course, since the last few administrations, particularly since Ronald Reagan, we have had a redistribution program in the United States that beats all. It's the very famous Hood-Robin program, stealing from the poor and giving it to the rich. And it's been extraordinarily successful, but the rich, of course, don't realize that their heads won't look all that good on pikes. And that's what's going to happen eventually, I'm afraid. You know, one of the problems is that the people who run the world feel the system has to be perfect because it bubbled them to the top. And so they, at most, even the big liberal foundations and so on, they're run by rich people who can't imagine that there are really fundamental problems with our society that can't be solved by little minor adjustments, by changing the tax rates a little or driving more electric cars or, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's just not going to work. There's every sign that it's not going to work.
This paper that you just constructed for the Royal Society about how do we avoid this collapse, could you give us 101 avoiding collapse?
101 avoiding collapse is basically learning to treat other people in our environment very differently. We have got to get off of the idea that growth is good, growth is bad. Consumption as a whole, we've got to move very rapidly, of course, to smaller populations and to supplying people with things that really give them the things that are important in life. That is, I firmly believe in refrigerators. It keeps your food from spoiling, keeps your beer and white wine cold. But the refrigerator should be built to last forever, basically. And that can be said for the main things that give our lives what we really want. But even at that level, there's no way you can do it, as we've proven, with 7 billion people. In other words, everybody who says, oh, it's going to be so easy to die. I remember when there were 3.5 billion people, when we wrote the population bomb, they kept saying, not to worry, technology will give everybody, even give 5 billion people, wonderful lives and everything. Well, now we're over 7 billion, and 3 billion people are still basically living in misery. So we have proven that with our kind of species and our kinds of societies, you can't give great lives to 7 billion people. And that means we're going to have to humanely reduce the size of the population as rapidly as possible to way below, probably down to 1.5 or 2 billion people. How do you do that? The place to start is clear. Give equal rights to women. They don't have it anywhere in the world. Give them equal opportunities and make sure that every sexually active person has full access to contraception and backup abortion. And that is the place to start. And there's a lot of data that suggests that that could start the gradual decline in population we so badly need. If you want to save the environment, stop at one kid or absolute maximum of two. That's the single most important thing that individuals can do.
Well, Paul Ehrlich, thank you so much for your time, for your research and your thoughts.
Nice talking to you.
When we come back, the unknown or forgotten aspects of Martin Luther King's life and philosophy. Stay tuned.
Now the job facing the nation today is to get rid of poverty. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year is about $800 billion. That is what it is, the richest nation in the history of the world. It wouldn't take much to do what I'm talking about. It wouldn't take a great percentage of that national gross product to do what I'm talking about. If the haves are willing, to somehow join hands with the have-nots and, armed with compassionate traveler's checks, journey into that other country of their brother's hurt and denial and neglect. It wouldn't take that much. We've done it before.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. While much of the country remembers Martin Luther King Jr. as primarily a leader of civil rights and desegregation and a great orator, our next guests say he stood for so much more. But many aspects of his life, legacy, and philosophy remain either unknown or conveniently forgotten. We are joined by three experts. David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize, Civil Rights Reader. He also served as senior advisor for Eyes on the Prize, the award-winning PBS television history series. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belongings. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thomas Jackson, you wrote in your book, From Civil Rights to Human Rights, that to understand Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. fully, we must understand who inspired him and whom he sought to persuade. Who did inspire him and who did he seek to persuade?
That is a great and sweeping question. One of the theses of my book is that there's a remarkable consistency over his life course in the degree to which he thought that you couldn't really achieve racial justice without economic justice and indeed without addressing issues of international peace. And that seems to be just a consistent thread throughout his life. First of all, his father and grandfather inspired him as sort of social gospel ministers dedicated to serving their communities. When he was in college and then graduate school, people like Howard Thurman, dean of chapel at Boston University, he was influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr, the socialist theologian in Detroit. His reading of Walter Rauschenbusch from the 19th century, a social gospel minister. This is sort of social gospel or even socialist Protestant thinkers and preachers. And that was quite formative. But there's a whole list of people, a whole group of them around Howard University who had been influenced by Gandhi as well, but also by egalitarian and revolutionary idea of Christianity. He sought to persuade everybody. He sought to persuade and bring together what you would need to produce a national reform constituency first, and then what he hoped would be a revolution of values. So principally, he was speaking to black communities to get them committed and mobilized for protest, and that was a rhetoric of black unity and Christian service. He sought to speak to the vast middle class majority, the electorate, in terms that would appeal to their sense of patriotism, but also fairness and justice, and in many ways their religious commitment to the least among them. And he sought to persuade policy elites. So he had a whole circle of advisors, and David Garrow knows a lot about this because he's unearthed a lot of it. But he sought to be an advocate, not only for civil rights legislation, but beyond that, for a robust war on poverty that would include things like job creation and free medical care on models that he saw in Scandinavia and Western Europe. He was also someone who self-consciously spoke to the world. I think if you look at his Nobel acceptance speech and his Nobel lecture, go to that and see the degree to which, as a kind of prophetic Christian leader, he thought that he really needed to speak to issues of international peace and economic distribution.
David Garrow.
The first thing for listeners to appreciate about Dr. King was that he was first and foremost a Baptist minister. King identified as a preacher. The Dr. King that you can hear in the recorded church sermons which have survived is almost always oftentimes a more powerful, more personal, more striking speaker than when you listen to King giving a civil rights talk at some college or university, for example. Both when he was in seminary at Crozer Theological Seminary when he's in graduate school at Boston. As Tom mentioned, good many of the theologians and thinkers that he read during those school years, Reinhold Niebuhr in particular, had a significant impact on him. But more often than anything else, King is speaking from the Bible.
Joshua Inwood.
You know, as a geographer, I think one of the things that I find so interesting about King is he leads this movement that is arguably the most transformable to the spaces and places of the United States, at least since first contact with white Europeans with Native Americans. And I think the thing that you have to keep in mind with King, and I think when you think about King, is at his most basic level, he makes an argument for the way that we should live and connect with each other in the idea of community. And when I think about King and when I think about the things that really inspired him and some of the intellectual currents that he draws from that both Tom and David allude to in their work, it is that connection to space and place, which is very important to understand his transformative power as a social thinker and as a social revolutionary.
Josh Inwood, there's a concept that you articulated in one of your papers, which was the beloved community. How do you explain this?
As both David and Thomas talked about, King is first and foremost a Baptist minister, but King is also able to draw from both intellectual currents, European intellectual currents, and also currents within the African-American community to really articulate a kind of idea of community that he talks about as the beloved community, which is really a space where all lives are interconnected and respected, and where he hopes you can transform individual lives through the transformative power of what he talks about as agape love. And so for King, he really makes distinctions between these three forms of love, between an eros, which is a kind of romantic love, philia, which is the kind of love and companionship that friendship has. But then he talks about agape. And at its most basic level, agape is the ability to tell your oppressor that what you're doing to me is not only wrong and dehumanizes me, but it also dehumanizes you. And so when King is articulating this notion of a beloved community, he is really talking and working and thinking about the transforming of these relationships, both black-white relationships, but also ultimately, as Thomas outlines in his book, you know, he's really building towards this economic argument that its final manifestation in the Poor People's Campaign. If you go back and you look at the Poor People's Campaign and what King was trying to do in 1967 and 1968, particularly in Washington, D.C., getting people to come to Washington, that is the manifestation of what that beloved community is. And there was a whole political program that was tied to the Poor People's Campaign, everything from a kind of guaranteed national income to universal health care, to also trying to get folks to understand and engage with one another in a different kind of level than had been going on in the 1960s in the United States.
This leads to an aspect that all three of you have discussed in your papers about the difference between the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the reality of it. Thomas Jackson, you wrote that we remember him, Dr. King, primarily as the leader of the civil rights movement that would end legal segregation. But really, his philosophy was so much broader and so much deeper than this memory of him. What more do we need to understand about the omissions to understand him? And why do you think we have these omissions?
We tend to freeze him in time and think that he didn't develop or address issues like the Vietnam War or like these deeper issues of poverty that revealed themselves to be so intractable after the Civil Rights Act. So we tend to remember and freeze him in time and identify him with the dream. In order to get a national holiday, the nation, I think, needed to arrive at a more of a consensus picture of who this man was. Even though Mrs. King, in the congressional hearings, said, "Here is your opportunity, nation, to make a national holiday and to celebrate a man who died in the service of labor rights for the sanitation workers of Memphis." But that is, as you suggest, occluded or elided in our consensus national celebrations, and nothing more evident than in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. There are other communities, though, and you've heard of some samplings already, of people who remember different things that he said to audiences he was appealing to. Michael Honey, written a lot about King as a labor leader and who tried to forge a black labor alliance with so many unions. He didn't go on picket lines all the time, but rhetorically and in terms of his vision, it was very much one in which workers' rights and the rights especially to decent wages and collective bargaining protections were as sacred as the rights to life and liberty. So I think we don't remember that for the same reason that we have business pages of newspapers and not labor pages of newspapers. So there's a lot of contestation. I mean, a lot of people want to claim King as an opponent of affirmative action, or I got into an argument with his niece, whether he would have been a Republican today or not. So in order for the nation to celebrate him every year, there seems to be a least common denominator, but the richness of his activism and his life lives on, and you can see it in all these groups that try to keep his memory alive, especially the peace groups at the March on Washington last August, who were directly challenging the Obama administration's policies abroad in using King's words. There's a lot of debate and contestation within that legacy. It's not like it's a frozen or one-dimensional legacy.
David Garrow, you too have emphasized these omitted aspects. You actually used the word distorted in terms of Dr. King's vision. What do you see as the distortions?
I think most listeners are probably quite unfamiliar with how Dr. King sounded during the last 3 years of his life, 1966 to 1968. The King of those years was a very harshly spoken critic, not only of American foreign policy and the war in Vietnam, but of economic inequality here in the United States. And both in terms of what we can correctly label a democratic socialist economic vision that he's articulating those years, and how he, in very tough language, is denouncing the U.S. government's military behavior in Southeast Asia. King is a much tougher critic of the United States and American society than is really ever underscored at January holiday celebration.
Joshua Inwood, you haven't used the word distortion, but you noted some contradictions, particularly around this issue of militarism.
I very much agree with what David just said. King did not mince words when he talked about the triple evils of modern society, what he refers to as racism, materialism, and militarism. When he speaks to materialism, he's really thinking about kind of the unfettered capital accumulation that is both going on in the United States, but then also spreading throughout the world. And I think really if listeners want to get into this in a way and really try to understand how King had changed and how he had come to terms with American both militarism and capitalism, you really need to turn to his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. And in many respects, this is King's most radical work. And King is unabashed when he talks about how American military soldiers who are standing in solidarity and burning villages in Vietnam would never be able to live on the same street in Detroit, Michigan. It's interesting that we're having this conversation in the backdrop of the NSA leaks from Edward Snowden, and President Obama was just giving a speech talking about some of the reforms that he would like to see. In many respects, you go back and you look at King in the 1960s, and we are still struggling and still trying to come to terms with many of those triple evils in society. We have got governors throughout this country who refuse to expand Medicaid rolls for poor and low-income folks, who very much practice a kind of economic revanchism in engaging with poor communities. We have a government who is at least potentially wrapping up American citizens in surveillance. And if you think about King's life in terms of the COINTEL program, it's the same kinds of things that he spoke about. We are also in the midst of debates in the Congress where we have seen long-term unemployment benefits cut from poor and working people who have been unable to find jobs. We've got food stamp cuts that have been enacted or being debated. And we really are struggling again with those things that King talked about, particularly as it relates to those triple evils of modern society.
That's a perfect place to go into some of the struggles that he did face and the FBI surveillance of Dr. King. But let me first remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking with Joshua Inwood, David Garrow, and Thomas Jackson, who are experts on Martin Luther King. David Garrow, you've looked at the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King.
The FBI first began targeting Dr. King in 1962 and 1963 in the belief that he probably was being influenced by certainly one or more than one advisors who had previously been secretly active in and loyal to the American Communist Party in the early 1950s. So that hypothesis is what leads Robert Kennedy, as U.S. Attorney General, to authorize the wiretapping of Dr. King. The FBI, on its own, without any approval from the Attorney General, also begins using bugs as electronic recording devices, as distinct from telephone wiretaps, against Dr. King. And all of that electronic surveillance quickly leads the FBI into an entirely prurient interest in Dr. King's private life. So you have really incredibly distasteful government surveillance being targeted at King during all of the mid-1960s. But the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King was not unique. They were deploying even more electronic attention towards, for instance, the Nation of Islam, a quite small black sect that had really very little influence on anything. But the echoes of the FBI's behavior during the 1960s and early 1970s, with the scope of government surveillance practices that we've all read about in recent months, is a very, very powerful echo.
You mentioned RFK's authorization of the wiretap. How did the relationship eventuate between RFK, JFK, and Martin Luther King Jr.?
Both of the Kennedy brothers, from May and June of 1963 onward, were very strongly supportive of the civil rights movement and very actively in concert with Dr. King, notwithstanding what J. Edgar Hoover's FBI is consistently whispering in their ears. The same pattern then continues when Lyndon Johnson becomes president after John F. Kennedy's assassination. Johnson very courageously stands with King and the movement, especially in 1965, in putting forward the Voting Rights Act. But secretly behind the scenes, Johnson and scores of others know that the FBI is distributing and trying to peddle both these communist influence allegations and all of this detail about King's private life. But under the journalistic standards of the 1960s, nobody, television or newspapers, is actually using any of that FBI rumor. So there's a weird disjuncture between what people in government know privately and the public record of broadcast and news.
May I jump in here? It's Tom Jackson.
Yes.
I want to support that, but also, in perhaps a way, qualify or complicate it. I agree. I don't think King was. I think he might have been concerned and maybe a bit intimidated, but it didn't suppress what he was willing to go out on a limb on. And I think the work I'm doing right now in 1963 and 1964 suggests that King and a number of other civil rights leaders, while working in concert with Kennedy and Johnson, also tried to put pressure for more, especially for more robust economic policies, but also for more vigorous protection for civil rights and civil liberties in Southern voting rights campaigns where people were being murdered and brutalized. So that when David talks about King's radicalism from 66 to 68, I see that already in 63 and 64. And it's the FBI can't suppress things that he says. There's a speech when he returns from his Nobel Prize. And it's not the FBI, it's the New York Times that doesn't get the word out. He comes back. First of all, the Times quotes him as basically saying, "I'm returning with a conviction that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time." Well, sitting there in the audience is Robert Wagner, Mayor of New York, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, and later on that night, the same speech Malcolm X hears. What King actually says in this speech, and hasn't yet been published, is that before he went to Oslo, he thought the war on poverty, it's the 50th anniversary this week of the war on poverty, he thought it'd be a step in the direction of establishing economic justice, and he was encouraged by the Pope's powerful message on poverty after his visit to India, that nations really need to cease their armament race and devote themselves to assisting those who lack food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. He says, though, in Norway and Sweden, whose economies are literally dwarfed by the size of our affluence and the extent of our technology, they have no unemployment and no slums. Men, women, and children have long enjoyed free medical care and quality education. And he says, this contrast to the limiting and halting steps of the war on poverty, our rich nation is deeply troubling when more than 40 million Americans, white and Negro, live in grinding poverty. Today, that number hasn't basically changed a bit more. The poverty rate, ironically, is higher today. So he was speaking to these issues back in that era of civil rights reform and cooperation with liberalism. But the press wasn't picking up on the message. If you listen to the audio tape of him talking to John Kennedy immediately after the March on Washington, he and the rest of the civil rights leadership is saying, we need full employment, we need a jobs program, we need something much more vigorous than what you're offering. And Kennedy kind of deflects them and says, no, we need you to support the civil rights bill and to exert your influence on Republicans. So there is both cooperation and kind of challenge and conflict going on, even in that period, on these very issues that most people think only emerged later. They were already on the table in 63 and 64.
Thomas Jackson, since you're talking about the media, there's a section of your book that talks about how the media obsesses about violence and really makes the story about violence. And perhaps that's why they're emphasizing the nonviolent talk. But I think you even have a quote in your book about how they are tallying up broken heads.
Box scores of broken heads. That's a quote from Pat Waters, a famous journalist of the Southern Movement, when he's denouncing the way in which newspapers covered the essentially nonviolent black movement. They're basically, what's newsworthy is when these things become violent and there's a fight. But I do think that it's kind of a huge smokescreen. When you look at the March on Washington, for example, half the news coverage is about, is this going to turn violent? How do we avoid violence? What logistics of control are necessary to prevent violence? And then after the march, what a relief that it was nonviolent and how praiseworthy that the Negro leadership was able to keep it nonviolent. And so that obsession with violence is very much noise and tends to drown out some of the substantive grievances and demands like civil liberties, protections, or jobs.
Joshua Inwood, let's put this into a geographic context. One way that you've looked at this is how memory has been created through, say, naming street signs after Martin Luther King and such.
There's kind of two ways to think about that. And we've talked a bit about the way that King is memorialized and the way that King is remembered. And the thing about memorials are, it's a way of concretizing an image. You can see that in the Washington, D.C. memorial, where you've got that image of King and that larger statue and the words that are inscribed in the monument. And it's really a kind of moment for us to think about and to recall certain aspects of King's legacy. But in recalling certain aspects of King's legacy, we are also forgetting other aspects of King's legacy. And so I think we always have to be a little bit careful when we start to memorialize leaders. And I think it's incredibly important where you have someone like King, who really is a social revolutionary, about how we kind of come to think about him and how we come to memorialize him. But I think it's also important to remember as well on King Day that King's work was only possible because there were thousands of others who were willing to not only take to the streets, but to do the hardcore political organizing that is necessary for someone like King and his mission and his activism to have success. And you can see that in countless spaces and countless places, particularly in the American South. If you go to Alabama, if you go to Mississippi, there's a lot of folks there who are working very hard behind the scenes to register people for the NAACP, to register people for the right to vote. That's what King is able to draw on and draw from when the political conditions come together to make his activism possible. We tend to think about King as just emerging here in the 1950s as kind of this great leader. But the reason he was able to emerge in the 1950s with the Montgomery bus boycott is because the political conditions had been created because of decades of struggle that had come before it. So that is something that is very important to think about as we think about 21st century American spaces and places, and with the ways that we can engage in the contemporary struggle to take on many of the inequalities that Thomas just alluded to. Because, I mean, unemployment or poverty, for example, we still live with large numbers of poor people despite the fact that we've been, quote-unquote, at war with poverty for 50 years. So that is something I think that listeners need to pay special attention to on King Day and when thinking about King and his legacy and what he means both to us and for us as a nation.
There are two things that that brings up. One is the celebrity obsession that our culture has that does discount the rest of the community.
Yeah.
The other aspect, which I think this was also in Thomas Jackson's book, dealt with King as the mediator between the sort of moderate and militant movements for civil rights. He thought they were both ineffective on their own.
No question about it. I think another thing that we have to keep in mind about King's legacy is there was also a very conservative African-American element that was as distrustful of King as some of the more radical elements in the African-American community. And so King is constantly buffered between these different aspects of the African-American community, these different parts of the African-American community, as he is trying to navigate this very complex political situation that presents itself in the 1960s in the United States.
David Garrow.
Certainly. Josh made perhaps the most important point of all, and that's that the civil rights struggle was a mass movement. Yeah. People think of King as the leader of it, but it's more accurate to think of him as a spokesperson for it. In the Nobel Prize context, he stressed that he was a trustee representing all of these tens of thousands of other people. He indeed should be seen as a representative of others and not just as a singular leader.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for your work and thank you for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you,
thank
Maria.
Thank you very much.
It's been great. Pleasure.
David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize, Civil Rights Reader. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belonging. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. And extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week. And to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.